Okay, so welcome everybody to the Q&A session for March the 4th. Quite a few people said that they really enjoyed last week when we had lots of topics. That depends on who sends in what, so if you like lots of topics, then you have to send us some topics. We do have quite a few tonight, but a lot of them are kind of questions that came in for which Chris and I don't really have any answers, so we'll get to some of those right now. So the first thing came in was, actually these are, the first couple I think are from the survey that we did, and the question was, can you transition to iTunes Music on a new Windows 11 computer, or alternatively, are iTunes and Zoom supported if you convert a Windows 10 computer to use Linux? So the first question was answered by Alison. I put these questions into the members forum to try and get some answers, and Alison said that yes, you can indeed use iTunes with Windows. She didn't remember exactly how she did it, but basically it looks like she copied the library from her old computer to an external USB drive and then copied it onto the new Windows 11 computer. And she confirmed that iTunes works just fine on Windows 11. In terms of running Zoom on a Linux box, you certainly can do that. I most frequently use Linux rather than Windows. And if you log on to Zoom, at zoom.com here, and look for the download page, it has recognized that I am running Linux, and you'll notice down the bottom there it says, please select a Linux type, and so it's offering me downloads for all kinds of different Linux distros, for example, Linux Mint, and if you install it, then you can see here, this is Zoom with the video settings window open, running on a Linux desktop background. So you certainly can use Zoom with Linux. Okay, next up we have a follow-up from Stuart. So Stu, you'll have to unmute yourself. And this is a follow-up on his thoughts last week about translation.
Yeah, I was looking at translation software last week, and something that occurred to me was I often have to translate stuff from French into English because living in Quebec, it's sort of a given that most people are speaking or writing in French. But I've never come across a Native American language translator. So I just did a little digging and I found a web page that will let me translate English into Native American languages, but not the other way around. So, halfway there. It's very simple. You just type what you want in English into the box on the screen, and it'll spit it out in the language of your choice. You just have to know what the name of that language is, be it Huron, Abenaki, whatever. I mean, there's so many. But the... it's a start. Everything else is paid services, so this is free, and you can fool around with it to your heart's desire. However, this is just one page on a bigger website, and if you could go to the next screen, Alan. Translator Mind has a gazillion pages on it that will translate into all sorts of things. For example, if you want to speak in 1500s English, this page on their website will let you do that. Pretty me lad. Wouldst thou like a tussle in the rye? Or something like that will come out depending on what you're asking. I wouldn't say such a thing myself. Or you could try the Dr. Seuss translator. A beer for me, would you? Could we? A beer? And it goes on and on and on. The point of these things is to show that the web page is about having fun as well as actually communicating there's so many translators there that the website, it says it tries to give each one a certain personality. So I know you could ask a general purpose artificial intelligence to do any of these things that this page will do, but it may not come out as well. Anyway, if you feel like having some fun or trying to translate into North American languages, translatormind.com looks like a bit of fun.
Carol's asking, do they give you a drop-down of selections or do you have to know what language you want?
Well, you can search if you know how to spell it. And there are 73 streams of full pages of listings of things to translate into in some form, some sort of order. I think it's alphabetical, but whose alphabet, I don't know. So if you find a page you like, you better bookmark it because you may not find it again.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Stuart. And the next one is yours, too.
Speaking of communicating, one of the websites I was browsing through this past week mentioned Kini, which is a TELUS sub-brand, and it seems to be catering to Filipina immigrants to Canada specifically, but they will take anybody's money. So if you want a basic plan, $25 for 25 gigabytes for Canada-wide calling and texting, there you go. They have a interesting loyalty program where if you keep renewing every month or every 3 months or some sort of schedule, you could wind up with up to 75 gigabytes a month for $25 simply by sticking with them for a couple years. So if you're in Canada and you're looking for a relatively inexpensive company to try, this may be one for you.
Does that include calls and messaging?
That's right. Canada. And then there are long distance packages you can tack on. As I say, it's catering to new immigrants. So there's a focus on inexpensive plans to specific countries. But go to the website and dig around. As I say, the article indicated it was focusing on Filipino immigrants, but hey, except for the Native Americans, we're all immigrants of one sort or another, right?
Right.
Even the Native Americans.
Just to be clear there, Stuart, it's Canada-wide and unlimited telephone calls and text.
Yes.
Right, and then international plans if you want to.
I think specific countries.
Yeah, okay.
Or something like that.
Right, thank you very much. Okay, next up, back to the survey. One of the questions that came in, I'm let off this on both counts. What's a good password manager that will work with a PC running Windows 11 and also an iPhone running iOS 26? I don't have Windows 11 and I don't have an iPhone, so I clearly can't answer that question. If anybody knows the answer, put something in the chat or send us an email, and we'll return to that another time. Another question about scanners. Are there any AI tools that can be used, along with a scanner, to extract elements from a photo or a document and then save those elements to a file? So I think what you're seeing here is you would scan something and then use AI image editing tools probably to pull out individual images or maybe text or something. So AI tools that can be used with a scanner for those kind of purposes. Anybody has any information on that? We'd like to know about it. And I see here Ian has said that Bitwarden is a password manager that will work with both Windows 11 and an iPhone. So there's a solution for you if that suits your purposes. Okay, next up, a question about cookie pop-ups. This is specific, starts off at least specific to TD Bank. They have a pop-up message which says, which offers to manage cookies for you on their website. And this individual says she's checked, unchecked all the things, she's checked all the things. Whatever she does, it still pops up again every time she has a web page change. I'm not sure about that. I tried this on TD Bank and managing my cookies. Next time I logged in, it didn't ask me for it. I basically told them only give me the necessary ones, turn everything else off. And next time I logged on, I didn't see that message. So I don't know whether it works or not. But the more general question is, you get these pop-ups all the time now on all kinds of websites, and trying to control them, is there a way to do it? So she says, how can I manage these pop-ups on a one-time basis? Is there any such animal that will do that? And again, I really don't know the answer to that question.
Well, if you do use uMatrix or uBlock Origin, you can block the cookie law URL, which is what they all seem to refer to, and I never get any pop-ups.
Okay. And Franz Picard here says, Chris's presentation says KeePass is a password manager. And I know that works on Windows 10 and Android. I don't know. I'm sure it works on Windows 11. I assume that means it works on iPhones as well, but I really don't know. Anyway, there's a couple of options for that. Okay, so next up we have a follow-up on fixing computers, and this one's from Jeff Dubois. So Jeff, if you're out there somewhere, you'd like to unmute your microphone and tell us all about these applications.
Okay, well, we were talking last week. There was some discussion about some USB tools and different things, some bootable solutions, and computer repair and diagnostic and things like that. So I was thinking that there were a few that probably were not mentioned, and it might be worthwhile to touch base on some of them. Some people are probably familiar, some maybe, some may not be, so it might be a bit of review. Alan, when I touched base with you earlier, you said you thought you, Chris perhaps had talked about CPU ID, CPU-Z, and I think there was one other, maybe it was Tech Power Up, GPU-Z, I don't really remember. But anyway, the five that came to mind, well, actually four came to mind immediately, was CPU ID, CPU-Z, Open Hardware Monitor, Passmark's RAMMon, Tech Power Up's GPU-Z, and then Speccy. So those were sort of five, and I can briefly just talk about them. Next slide, please. So CPU ID, CPU-Z, this is an open source tool. Now, it has a number of tabs. I just did a quick screenshot. Most of these tools I run on all of my machines. This has a series of tabs that you can access for the it's really in-depth in the amount of detail it gives, so you can find out information on your CPU, on the motherboard, on the memory, on the SPD, and on the graphics card, as well as accessing benchmark information. What this is really handy for is if you just, to find the model number, the exact model of your motherboard or your CPU, so it's going to give you really good in-depth information about your system. The SPD tab, that's the acronym is Serial Presence Detect. Basically, it's going to give you information on the memory sticks that are in your computer, in the how many slots you have, and what's in each. One of the problems with most of the tools that I've found over the years is that they might tell you, for example, oh, you have 16 gigabytes of RAM in this machine, but there's not a lot of tools that will tell you what the capacity of your motherboard might be. So you might know what stick and the manufacturer, the model name, the manufacturer, the speed, the clock speed. You might know all of that from these tools, but you may not know the capacity of the motherboard. There used to be a really good tool on Crucial.com. It might actually still be there. Stuart posted a note in the forum a month or so ago, noting that Crucial was no longer be selling memory to the consumer market. I'm presuming that tool will be taken offline if it hasn't already. I have found another alternative, Mr. Memory. I'll try to do a follow-up on that in a couple of weeks. So that's something we can come back to. But this is a CPU ID, CPU-Z open source software, and the link is there. So you want to take a look at that. Next slide, please. So now open hardware. Again, this is another open source piece of a utility, a little application. And this too gives you information on the on your main processor, your graphics card processor, voltages, the load and clock speeds. What I really like about this, and I again this one's on all of my computers. I like the very simple interface. It's one screen. And I can immediately see the fan speeds on my computer, so I can access this very quickly. The other thing, a number of the utilities, I keep a utilities directory right under my C drive, so it's C:\utils, and in there will be a directory with open hardware, and the executable just sits there. So it's very easy for me to run. I just open Explorer, a couple of clicks, and it's running. Depending how much real estate is on my screen, I might even have this sitting in some of these utilities in the corner of my desktop. But normally I just run them I'm from the days of the command line prompt, so. For me to go into Explorer and click on the executable, I don't find that a big deal. So if you're just looking for something simple, Open Hardware Monitor is another good alternative. Next slide, please. Passmark's RAMMon. This is just good for finding information about the memory. That's in your computer and which slots. It's again, this will not report, as I was saying, most of them won't tell you what your motherboard is capable of handling, but you can certainly see on a single screen very easily without too much digging what manufacturer, what RAM sticks, what type, what speed is in which slots, and whether you have available slots. So that's another, if all you're looking for is RAM, I'd go with Passmark immediately, the same as Open Hardware. If I just want to know my fan speed, I use Open Hardware, more in-depth CPU-Z. Next slide, please. So Tech Power Up. This is a really good tool for if you want to have more in-depth information about your graphics cards. So whether you're NVIDIA, AMD, ATI, or Intel processors for your graphics, you can get all kinds of information about the card with this tool. whether it's the name or the bias or the memory size. Not sure if it's on that screen. This is the when I did all of this, these slides, I was working off of my old Plunker desktop. So this has got a raging 4 gigabyte card here. This is a super powerhouse, as you can tell. But again, this machine is, I don't do anything heavy on this. It's mostly a file server, print server. And this will tell you your temperature and fan speeds as well, which can be really handy. I was actually watching this a little closer because, I use it, believe it or not, I use these tools to know when it's time to get the compressor out and blow the blow the dust off the video cards. If I notice the temperature going up and the machine seeming to be a little sluggish or occasionally powering down, it's time to get the compressor out and the hand compressor or the dust off cans and blow them out. Because they do, as you know, they tend to be real magnets for dust. So this is a good tool for that. Next slide, please. This one I'm going to start off by saying, it's time to eat your vegetables. Don't leave the dinner table unless you don't clean your plate, Jeffrey, and eat your vegetables. I'm saving the best for last. I only came across this utility when I was preparing these slides for Alan this week. I had no idea that this tool even existed, and I was looking for some information on one of the other utilities, and I just stumbled on this by accident. When I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to leave the table until we ate all our vegetables. So I would always eat my vegetables first because I liked them the least, and then I would sit at the table. And so I'm saving this the best for last. This is the meat of the meat and the potatoes. Why I really like this is it gave you a quick summary page, and it literally has everything. It's this is Avast, if you're familiar with Avast. C Cleaner, I guess, is Avast. People might be familiar with C Cleaner. I don't use C Cleaner myself, but I'm certainly aware of it, and I'm pretty sure Chris has talked about it in the past. But this is a nice little all-round utility. You can it does give you the summary page right off the bat, so you can sort of see a general overview fairly quickly of what's in a particular machine. But then you can get real detailed information on each of those units in the machine, whether it's your processor or the memory or your graphics card or in with Speccy, it's even network information and peripherals and audio drivers. You can see driver versions numbers. So this is quite quite an interesting little utility. Now, I generally like portable utilities as well that can be run off of I generally throw all these onto a USB drive. I just came across this utility, so I'm told that there's a portable version on the Avast CCleaner website. I couldn't find it. I'm told it's there, though, but I couldn't find it. There is a version of it, though, on portable apps. So maybe there's, in a couple of weeks, I'll try to talk about portable apps and older geeks and some of these places that you can find these older devices. But this one I would recommend as well, as it's, you know, another CCleaner, fairly reputable. So those are the five tools that I would recommend. There's all the links for them. They're all there. And so you should be able to find them there. They're also on my website. There's a link to my website. There's a whole section on computer analysis, computer resources. There's a tab there, and all of these resources and more is there. So if that's of interest to anybody, feel free to take a look around. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jeff. Okay, back to the questions, again from the survey. One of the questions was, is it necessary, is it absolutely necessary to switch from Windows 10 to Windows 11? And the answer is no, at least not now. As you can see here, this is my Windows 10 machine, and my Windows 10 machine is enrolled for the ESU program, so I'm getting security patches at least until October the 13th of this year. The question, of course, is what happens after that? So I went on to the Microsoft website, and if you look at this page, a couple of interesting things here. It talks about the ESU program starting on the 14th of October, when Windows 10 nominally ran into end of life. And notice it says that it's available for customers while they transition to Windows 11. So that suggests to me that it's a kind of a grace period, and I actually don't expect the ESU program to be extended after the fall of this year. And notice again, it says you can enroll in the ESU program anytime until the program ends. So again, they're saying that the program will end on October the 13th of 2026. So the fall of this year, we're back to that Windows 10 end of life problem, and you have to decide what to do next. If you can't upgrade to Windows 11, how are you going to deal with Windows 10 end of life? And we've talked about that ad nauseum, I think, for the last year, so everybody should have a pretty good idea of what they're going to do. Anyway, no doubt we'll come back to it again at some point. In the meantime, let's move on to Tom. Tom has got a presentation for us on a package called ShutUp IO, or ShutUp 10, I'm not quite sure which. So Tom, you'll have to unmute yourself and you have control. Are you going to take control, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I shall unmute myself and take control. I'm the boss now. Okay, I want to share my screen. Share. Place current share. Screen one. There. Okay. Can you all see that?
Yeah, you just need to make it go into slideshow mode.
Yes. I think I should be in slideshow mode now. Let me see. Okay, so who's spying on you? Well, this presentation is about one way to turn off the spying of one player, Microsoft. So it's all about counter-spy program Ono ShutUp 10, because it was originally created for Windows 10 to fix Microsoft settings for telemetry. Because every day, in every way, Microsoft is spying on you. Some diagnostic data, required some optional activity history, browsing search history, and an advertising ID to identify you for, guess what? There is some required diagnostic data. This stuff goes off to Microsoft, whether you like it or not, unless you maybe block it with Windows Firewall Control or in your firewall otherwise. The device identity, the OS details, update and reliability status, app compatibility, and Microsoft Store info. So all that stuff you can't turn off with this tool. But there's a lot you can turn off. app activity and feature usage, the stuff that you kind of is way more personal to you. So your browsing history, crash memory dumps, which can include stuff that you were thinking was private, including pictures and other stuff, health stuff that you have on your computer, device health signals, performance, battery impact of apps. There are other things, groupings too, as well as this, which is diagnostic data that Windows uses. There's activity history, which includes apps used, files opened, websites browsed, and the advertising ID, which allows advertisers to determine that you're this particular ID and you're doing these things, and therefore since you're interested in A, you'll be interested in A+. Now, what Microsoft says they use it for is for security and reliability. For cross-device sync, if you use a Microsoft account that's online and you use it on several computers, then all of this stuff, either in Windows or in Edge, when you use sync, Microsoft can see your stuff. It's not encrypted on the way back and forth. It's just there available if they want to look at it. Feature and improvement performances like bug fixes, app activity in device characteristics that affect health and battery, and of course, ads. Now, ONO Shutup is, I'll put the link in the chat. You decide for yourself what Windows 10 and 11 functions should be active and which data Windows is allowed to transfer. They're all in one place, and you can adjust them. So how does it work? The things that it adjusts inside of Windows are the registry, some registry keys, some group policy, which if you're with Windows Home, you cannot change yourself, services, app controls, AI, recall, and co-pilot settings, and scheduled tasks. All of these things are used to communicate information to Microsoft. But you have to be careful because it is a very powerful tool. And I don't know. I haven't done anything bad to myself, but I'm pretty conservative. So you may want to take precautions. So I would suggest you create a restore point before you do any changes. It's in the action menu, so create a restore point. The green switches are pretty safe and don't much affect how Windows works. The other one, red switches, affect how Windows works, AI and other stuff, and you decide what controls you want. But Windows Update may reset some switches. So if Windows Update has run and updated you every month or more often, then you may want to revisit this. And Shutup 10 allows you to save your setup so you can just reapply it with a single click. So this is how. Download it from this particular URL. Run it. It does not need installing. You can put it on a USB key and use it to set up several computers without any installation. And all the settings are stored inside of Windows. That's why you can move it around. So here's how. Here's an example window. This is ONO Shutup 10. I'm running it as an administrator. I think it requires you to run it as an administrator because it's affecting the registry and other things. Create a system restore point. Apply only the recommended settings. That's what I do. And then if you want to, you can look through the red switches and the yellow dots here to see whether or not there are things that you want to change one way or another. Consider anything that's yellow or red as to something you want to do, whether you want to change it or not. So these are there's a whole bunch of them. There's probably 150 or 200 different switches, so you can look through them all. How 3. You can change the settings for both the current user, and for the local machine. And you change them all in the same ways. It's just a question of sort of mostly where in the registry it is, but whether it affects the whole machine or just the current user. And there's a third tab, Copilot. And this is where you you can disable or remove the Copilot application. And if you've ever run Recall, which can run on some very recent machines, then you can securely erase everything that was stored by Recall. So you can do that in this particular tab, the Copilot tab. Now, there are alternatives. They are not as simple or clean as I recall, but here they all are. iShampoo, Windows Privacy Tweaker, there are a whole bunch of them. You can Google them to see whether they're good for you. And I have to credit slidesgo.com for the fancy template that I used. Are there any questions?
I didn't see anything, Tom, in the... No, I don't think so. Okay, so thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we should be back to... Okay, so moving along, I have a share, which I thought was kind of interesting. This research team at a technical university in Austria has created the world's smallest QR code. And it turns out you need an electron microscope to be able to read it, because it's only 2 micrometers square. So it's a pretty tiny QR code. I don't think my phone has the right resolution to do that one. So it says you can't even use an optical microscope. You have to use an electron microscope. And all it really does is point to a web page on the university's website. But the interesting thing is, looking at this as a futuristic type storage medium, if you had a cartridge, whatever they decide is a cartridge, but basically some device that's 100 by 100 by 20 millimeters, so essentially around about the same size as a portable external USB drive, using this kind of technology, you could actually get almost 300 terabytes of data onto that fairly small volume. And because it's on this ceramic material, it's probably going to last possibly forever, or at least for a very long time. So it really is carved in stone. So something to look forward to maybe in the somewhat distant future. Okay, final thing I have is this business of things that are monitoring you. And I got this for this somebody, an ex-colleague of mine sent me this paper, which is talking about non-CDR data sources. Now this is a paper from last year, 2025, and non-CDR data sources are kind of interesting to me because I worked on CDR data sources quite a while ago. So for those of you who don't know, My previous existence was a researcher in motor vehicle safety, and we were using event data recorders, which are onboard crash recorders in vehicles. So one of the discussions at the time, this is, 25 years ago, the discussion was, are these things black boxes, and are they spying on you, as Tom would have it, or are they silver bullets, and they're going to be the answer to all of the safety researchers' prayers, because they're going to tell us everything that's going on in motor vehicle crashes. And when you think about black boxes, you think about aircraft, and aircraft don't actually use black boxes. They're painted bright orange so that when the plane crashes, the on scene techs can actually find the so-called black box, the flight recorder. So those are not black boxes, and neither are these. These are my silver bullets. These are actually SDNs, sensing and diagnostic modules. They're basically airbag control units from from vehicles 20 years ago. But they do have some recording capability. Built. Not only do they sense and control the airbag firing, but they also record things about the crash. So that's why they're kind of monitoring systems. So we had some technology. We had this nice blue box at the bottom here, which was a piece of hardware that interfaced with the sensing module. And then we could use a laptop computer and software to actually get a readout from the box. And in the early days, you got pretty basic data. It tracked things like vehicle speed, engine speed and RPM, the position of the throttle, and the status of the brake switch. And you got 5 readings at 1 second intervals prior to the crash, which triggered the recording system. So for example, here's a real world example. You can see the red line here is the vehicle speed. Interestingly enough, the sensing is all done by accelerometers in meters per second squared, but of course these are American devices, so they convert everything to imperial units. So you can see the vehicle trotting down the road at about 38 miles per hour. The red line is basically horizontal until you get to T-minus 2 seconds prior to the crash. You see the red line drops off, so the speed is dropping down, and that's because the guy has taken his foot off the accelerator. You see the blue line was going about 12% throttle body, and it drops down to zero with 1 second to go. So he's taken his foot off the gas. The engine RPMs in green are dropping. The engine speed in red is dropping. And at the same time, when he took his foot off the accelerator, the purple line shows that he put his foot onto the brake, but only with, between 2 and 1 second to go. He starts to brake. That's probably not going to be a good thing, and we probably know that because we've got a recording, so there was a collision. The more important, more interesting thing here is the actual change in velocity that we're seeing. So now we're getting recordings from this accelerometer every 10 milliseconds, and then we integrate the acceleration to get velocity, so we can see how the velocity of the vehicle, the speed of the vehicle drops, over time. So you get like 80 to 300 milliseconds depending on the type of vehicle and accelerometer unit in there. So here's a real world example. You can see the speed has dropped by about 80 miles per hour. So it's 18 and a half miles per hour after the velocity change. And you can see that happened in about 120, 130 milliseconds. So that's about a tenth of a second, the collision is essentially over. So if you think about that in terms of when you hit the brakes, you might have 2 or 3 seconds to come to a stop. If you hit the wall, you have a tenth of a second or so to come to a stop. So it's a much more severe type impact if you hit something solid rather than coast gently to a stop. Now, the unit is doing all kinds of things. It's telling you that the driver's not wearing a seatbelt, and it knows the airbag was working, and it saw the delta V of about 80 miles an hour. That was over about 135 milliseconds, so a fairly long, slow pulse. And in 37 milliseconds, 37 and a half milliseconds, the airbag sensor met the criteria for deployment. So that's very useful for vehicle safety people, because otherwise you just see the deployed airbag. You've got no idea what happened in terms of when that thing deployed, and that turns out to be a critical element. If we think about real world stuff and look at, this is some data from the Defect Investigations Department in Transport Canada, public complaints. And this was a complaint from an Audi driver. He says he took his foot off the brake and the vehicle just bolted forward and he hit the back of another vehicle. Now, however, you can see here that he had his brake, he had his foot on the brake, sure enough, the red dots, for quite a while. But then when he took his foot off the brake, he clearly put his foot onto the accelerator, and it goes from 50% up to 99% before he thinks about getting off the accelerator again. So clearly this is a what we call a pedal error. He took his foot off the brake and he hammered the accelerator by mistake, and that caused the crash. Get a lot of these unintended acceleration complaints. Oops, sorry. And here's almost two dozen incidents, and you notice we rank them here, where people were complaining that they had their foot hard on the brake and yet the vehicle was accelerating away from them. But you can see that they actually, in the green here, they had their foot hard on the accelerator and not even touching the brake. And then every now and again there were intermittent applications of the brake. And it's only this one down here where he's not on the accelerator, but he gets on the brake late before the actual thing hits something. So the vehicle is telling you all kinds of things about what drivers are doing. And that becomes even more critical these days, because now you've got advanced driver assistance systems. So you've got automatic braking kicking in, lane keeping assist, runoff roadway assist, all kinds of wonderful things. The vehicle's monitoring what's happening and taking control. And if you don't have the electronics to tell you, then you'd never know what was actually happening. So this kind of monitoring and recording is really important from a vehicle safety perspective. Right, so going back to the delta V, the change in velocity curve, these are actually crash tests. So now we've taken, this is Transport Canada, taking brand new vehicles, running them into walls at 48 kilometers an hour. And you can see that the delta V happens in about 100 milliseconds. So that tenth of a second, the crash occurs and is basically over in 100 milliseconds, and the vehicles essentially come to rest. So this kind of ties into our program of airbag research, where we were trying to find countermeasures for airbag-induced injuries. And this is a really tragic crash. This is the first child fatality in Canada. You can see there's basically almost no damage to this green Hyundai Accent. He basically had a minor rear-end crash into this white car. But there was a four-year-old male wearing a lap belt with a shoulder belt behind his back in the right front seat. The child rotated forwards, the airbag deployed, and he basically got a fatal neck injury. And one of the reasons for that is right here, because in the early days of airbags were designed and tuned to protect unbelted occupants in American vehicles in high-speed crashes. So this is looking at the firing times. Remember, we know exactly how long it takes for the airbag to fire in a crash based on those recordings. The red bars down here are basically crash tests, and you can see that the airbag is being deployed in about 10 milliseconds maximum. I mean, really, really quick. So that's what I mean by the airbag is tuned for high-speed crashes. The problem is we had really high belt usage rates, so we didn't need protection for unbelted. We needed supplemental head protection to stop drivers hitting their head on the steering wheel in high-speed crashes. But we were stuck with these first-generation airbags, and you can see that they had long deployment times very often, nothing like 10 milliseconds down here. They're up into the 120 milliseconds at the extreme here. And if you remember, that means the crash is over. The airbag's essentially deploying at the same time that the crash is finished. That's not a good situation for people who are close to the airbag at the time of the crash. So we came up with all kinds of quick countermeasures, public education materials, a deactivation program for people who just couldn't get far enough away from the steering wheel. You probably remember the advice to put children under 10 in a rear seat, well away from the airbag. But the really important thing was to change the design of the airbag and basically depower these very aggressive airbag systems. So we're looking for second generation and eventually advanced airbag system with multi-stage airbags. So one of my colleagues was a really bright engineer. He came up with this brilliant crash test, and he basically put a deformable aluminium honeycomb on the front of a barrier, and he only let the vehicle impact it by about halfway overlap. So think about what's happening here. The vehicle goes into the barrier, and the other thing was, it was a crash up to 40 kilometers per hour. So a fairly moderate crash speed and could be quite low. The regulation was going to say up to 40 kilometers per hour. And the trick here is you say, well, you know, here's your vehicle, Mr. Manufacturer. You're going to run into this barrier. It's going to be a really soft pulse, long and slow and very benign type deceleration characteristics. And what I want you to do is decide when to fire your bag, but not to kill my dummy. So we have a fifth percentile female dummy in the front, representing a short female driver, fully forward, close to the steering wheel, and monitoring basically chest compression, head acceleration, and we don't want you to kill the dummy. A wonderful crash test. The other thing we had was what we call a chest on module test. This was a static deployment. So you arrange the fifth percentile female dummy so that the chest is right on the module, fire the airbag, and again, you can deploy the airbag, but deploy it softly so you don't kill my dummy. So the upshot of that was we did get depowering, we got much better sensing and control characteristics, and here's a crash, an actual real-world crash here. The driver is belted, and the maximum delta V is about 35 kilometers per hour in 105 milliseconds, so fairly severe crash in terms of the time frame anyway, one-tenth of a second again. And now we're deploying the airbag in less than, 30 milliseconds. So very early on in the crash phase. And this is a two-stage bag, so we're deploying both the first and second stages because we've got a fairly high-speed crash in a short time frame. And notice also we've now got pretensioners on the seatbelt. So the seatbelt pretensioner is being fired. That snugs up the belt and helps to protect the occupant at the same time. So those are kind of the early things. Moving on into more advanced systems. Now you can see that we're getting those speed and RPMs, but now we're getting the state of malfunction lights, whether the airbag's working or not. And now we're getting things like ABS, the steering wheel input, so we can see if the driver's steering left or right. And we get individual wheel speeds even in terms of braking and ABS and that kind of thing. And if you have the tire pressure monitoring system, then you also get the tire pressure on all of the wheels. And these days, some vehicles even take photographs. So you've got those forward-facing cameras which are tracking lead distance and lane-keeping assistance and looking for roadway markings, that kind of thing. But manufacturers can also take pictures with these things in the event of a crash. So you get a series of pictures here so you can see that this vehicle is actually stationary and the impacting vehicle here is actually approaching and you're getting this time series. This is actually stage, but if you think in terms of pedestrian protection, you've got sensing now that looks for pedestrians will automatically brake. So here they're staging a situation where the pedestrians can be in front of the car, and again you've got pictures of the pedestrian just before he gets run over. No, that was a stage incident, so he didn't get run over. Anyway, back to this thing. That was a long time ago, all that airbag stuff. But nowadays, you've got different technologies. So just think about some of the limitations of EDRs. If you have a really minor crash, you may not trigger a recording. And that's a particular problem when you've got pedestrians and cyclists because they're relatively lightweight compared to a heavy motor vehicle, and they don't generate, the vehicle doesn't generate a large enough delta V to trigger the recording. And the other issue is if the vehicle's stolen or it's actually an insurance fraud situation, then there won't be a recording either. So here the author's looking at all kinds of other ways that he might be able to get data on what's going on in various crash-type situations. So he's looking at the onboard navigation, satellite navigation systems, infotainment, telematics for onboard phones, and even things like bicycle computers and GPS apps on mobile phones. And it turns out there is software available, this Burla 4 software, will look into onboard vehicle systems and pull out things like trip logs and destinations, speed and direction from GPS systems. It will look at call logs and contact lists and which phones are being paired to the vehicle. And there are also systems that look for in-vehicle events like opening doors, switching on lights, and those kind of things. And they have timestamps and locations based on the clock and the GPS. So some examples that the author pulled out here, this is a GM product. There's a thing called a human-machine interface electronic control unit. And there's also OnStar, which is the satellite crash system that GM uses. This is an interesting case because when this is a consulting engineering firm, when they went to look for the vehicle, there's no SDM module on board. Somebody had actually removed the recording module for the airbag control module. So what they did was they looked at the onboard entertainment system and the GPS in particular. And what you're looking at here is that you're seeing the vehicle speed, and this is a Corvette. So I wonder if the vehicle speed being 100 kilometers per hour at the point of impact was something to do with why the vehicle got stolen. And just to go back here for a second, you can see that this is tracking the vehicle coming along the road here at one time, and then there's a whole bunch of points here at a different time. And this basically means that this is a point where the vehicle collided, and now the vehicle is just sitting here, and there's some scatter in the GPS readings, so you're getting a number of points, but the vehicle is actually stationary there. However, clearly vehicle speed was an issue, and yes, you need other kinds of data to pin more things down. Here's an example from a Ford product. This is again looking at a track, and the top right-hand corner here is where the vehicle's owner is, his place of work. Normally, he would follow this track to the left and then go south and then go back west again. And normally, he would turn right at that intersection, follow the red line, and basically go home. You notice on this one particular day, when the vehicle was recorded as being stolen, and reported as being stolen, you notice that down the bottom at this intersection is a whole bunch of blue dots, and then the blue dots carry on over here and end up over here where the vehicle was retrieved from a pond. It had been dumped off at a pond. So was it stolen and dumped off in the pond? Again, you've got those speed readings, and you can see there's some quite high speeds involved here. And when those speed readings were overlaid on top of Google Earth, you can see that he's doing almost 100 clicks trying to make this right-hand turn. He's obviously going way too fast to make a sharp right-hand turn, and he ends up going off into the boonies here. I don't know. He must have hit something here and caused some damage. Eventually, he gets back onto the road and then disappears off down to the final resting place in the pond. The other trick here was looking at some of those in-vehicle events. And there's all kinds of different events there which were analyzed. But the last one was kind of interesting. A phone being disconnected It was an iPhone, and the other data on board this vehicle showed that that iPhone that was the last thing to happen in that vehicle belonged to the vehicle owner. So obviously the thought there is that this is a insurance fraud where he's damaged the vehicle and then dumped it and reported it as being stolen. If you're a cyclist, you might have a bicycle computer, a computer that records speed and distance and time and all kinds of wonderful things. And you notice down the bottom here, it records a track of this individual's location. And if you take the data from that track log, and again overlay it on top of vehicle Google Earth, you can see that the cyclist tried to make the right-hand turn here and basically ended up hitting the pickup truck. And that confirmed the pickup truck driver's statement that the cyclist lost control and slid into his vehicle. And you're not even safe if you don't have onboard technology. This is a Strava app on a mobile phone. It lets you, again, track where you're going. This is an e-bike which is going around this bend and hit some pedestrians. Now, this is a national park, and the posted speed limit was 20 kilometers per hour. We can see here that the e-bike was doing about 55 kilometers per hour when it went around the bend. So, lots of technology which are monitoring you, so be careful what you do out there, people. Okay, I think I've gone over time a couple of minutes, so let's carry on to the wrap up. If you have a favorite application for a PC or a tablet or a smartphone, if you can't live without it, then probably there's other people who would like to know about it. So if you want to give us a short presentation, like the ones that Tom and Jeff and Stuart did tonight, show us how it works, why you like it so much, and maybe other people will take you up on it. If you are not a member of the club, we have a special offer. You join the club for $20 right now. That will get you a year's worth of membership, but we will throw in a second year's membership absolutely free. So you get 2 years membership for the price of one. If you are an existing member, your membership will automatically be renewed and you don't have to pay us a cent. A couple of questions that came in from the survey. What kind of specifications should you use if you're looking to buy a PC or a phone? And what's good in terms of Intel or AMD CPU chips? And the answer to that, I think you'll find in this last presentation that's noted here, how to buy a PC. Chris is going to be talking about that at the Orleans Library Branch on Friday at 2 p.m. He has a long presentation on all kinds of things about PCs, so that will be where those questions will be answered. Sooner than that, tomorrow night, Thursday, at the Greenborough branch, Linda is going to be talking about travel in Newfoundland, and in the evening, that's at 10:30 in the morning at Greenborough, and in the evening at 6, Chris has got his Fun with Fonts presentation at the Beaverbrook branch. Linda has a Newfoundland travel presentation coming up on March the 31st. I know that this one is at 7:30, and the URL is right there. It's also in the newsletter, I think. And next week, will be our regular March meeting, and Bill Van Dyke, one of our long-standing members, is going to be talking about network-attached storage systems for basically home use. So if you're interested in NAS systems, then that's the presentation for you next week. And that means that there won't be a Q&A next week, so our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks' time, March the 18th. Lots of time for you to send in your questions and the topics that you want to share with the group on March the 18th. So thank you very much, everyone, for attending. Thank you especially to Jeff and Tom and Stuart, especially to Stuart, because Stuart was sitting in for Chris today, and he was putting all that good stuff in the chat as we went along. So, again, hope everybody enjoyed tonight, and we'll see you on the, well, we'll see you next week at the monthly meeting, and on the 18th at the next Q&A.